The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued.
Cassette 4, Side 2.
Sleeplessness, yes, combined with standing, thirst, bright light, terror, and the unknown. What other tortures are needed? Befogs the reason, undermines the will, and the human being ceases to be himself, to be his own I. As in Chekhov's I Want to Sleep. But there it was much easier, for there the girl could lie down and slip into lapses of consciousness, which even in just a minute would revive and refresh the brain. A person deprived of sleep acts half unconsciously, or altogether unconsciously, so that his testimony cannot be held against him. Just picture a foreigner who knows no Russian in this muddled state, being given something to sign. Under these conditions, the Bavarian Jupp Aschenbrenner signed a document admitting that he had worked on wartime gas vans. It was not until 1954, in camp, that he was finally able to prove that at the time he had been in Munich, studying to become an electric welder. They used to say, "You are not truthful in your testimony, and therefore you will not be allowed to sleep." Sometimes, as a refinement, instead of making the prisoner stand up, they made him sit down on a soft sofa, which made him want to sleep all the more. The jailer on duty sat next to him on the same sofa and kicked him every time his eyes began to shut. Here is how one victim, who had just sat out days in a box infested with bedbugs, describes his feelings after this torture. Chill from great loss of blood. Irises of the eyes dried out as if someone were holding a red-hot iron in front of them. Tongue swollen from thirst and prickling as from a hedgehog at the slightest movement. Throat racked by spasms of swallowing. Sleeplessness was a great form of torture. It left no visible marks and could not provide grounds for complaint, even if an inspection, something unheard of anyway, were to strike on the morrow. Inspection, by the way, was so totally impossible, and had so emphatically never taken place, that in 1953, when real inspectors entered the cell of former Minister of State Security Abakumov, himself a prisoner by that time, he roared with laughter, thinking their appearance was a trick intended to confuse him. "They didn't let you sleep? Well, after all, this is not supposed to be a vacation resort. The security officials were awake, too." They would catch up on their sleep during the day. One can say that sleeplessness became the universal method in the organs. From being one among many tortures, it became an integral part of the system of state security. It was the cheapest possible method, and did not require the posting of sentries. In all the interrogation prisons, the prisoners were forbidden to sleep even 1 minute, from a valet till taps. In Sukhanovka and several other prisons used specifically for interrogation, the cot was folded into the wall during the day. In others, the prisoners were simply forbidden to lie down, and even to close their eyes while seated. Since the major interrogations were all conducted at night, it was automatic. Whoever was undergoing interrogation got no sleep for at least 5 days and nights. Saturday and Sunday nights, the interrogators themselves tried to get some rest. 22. The above method was further implemented by an assembly line of interrogators. Not only were you not allowed to sleep, but for 3 or 4 days, shifts of interrogators kept up a continuous interrogation. 23. The bedbug-infested box has already been mentioned. In the dark closet made of wooden planks, there were hundreds, maybe even thousands, of bedbugs, which had been allowed to multiply. The guards removed the prisoner's jacket or field shirt, and immediately the hungry bedbugs assaulted him, crawling onto him from the walls or falling off the ceiling. At first he waged war with them strenuously, crushing them on his body and on the walls, suffocated by their stink. But after several hours he weakened and let them drink his blood without a murmur. 24. Punishment cells. No matter how hard it was in the ordinary cell, the punishment cells were always worse, and on return from there the ordinary cell always seemed like paradise. In the punishment cell a human being was systematically worn down by starvation and also usually by cold. In Sukhanovka prison there were also hot punishment cells. For example, the Lefortovo punishment cells were entirely unheated. There were radiators in the corridor only, and in this heated corridor the guards on duty walked in felt boots and padded jackets. The prisoner was forced to undress down to his underwear, and sometimes to his undershorts, and he was forced to spend from 3 to 5 days in the punishment cell without moving, since it was so confining. He received hot gruel on the 3rd day only. For the first few minutes, you were convinced you'd not be able to last an hour, but by some miracle, a human being would indeed sit out his 5 days, perhaps acquiring in the course of it an illness that would last him the rest of his life. There were various aspects to punishment cells, as, for instance, dampness and water. In the Chernovtsi prison after the war, Masha G. was kept barefooted for 2 hours and up to her ankles in icy water. Confess! She was 18 years old, and how she feared for her feet. She was going to have to live with them a long time. 25. Should one consider it a variation of the punishment cell when a prisoner was locked in an alcove? As long ago as 1933, this was one of the ways they tortured S.A. Chebotaryev in the Khabarovsk GPU. They locked him naked in a concrete alcove in such a way that he could neither bend his knees nor straighten up and change the position of his arms, nor turn his head. And that was not all. They began to drip cold water onto his scalp, a classic torture, which then ran down his body in rivulets. They did not inform him, of course, that this would go on for only 24 hours. It was awful enough, at any rate, for him to lose consciousness, and he was discovered the next day apparently dead. He came to on a hospital cot. They had brought him out of his faint with spirits of ammonia, caffeine, and body massage. At first he had no recollection of where he had been or what had happened. For a whole month he was useless even for interrogation. We may be so bold as to assume that this alcove and dripping device had not been devised for Chebotaryev alone. In 1949, my Dnepropetrovsk acquaintance had been similarly confined, without the dripping attachment, however. On a line joining Khabarovsk and Dnepropetrovsk, and over a period of 16 years, were there not other such points as well? 26. Starvation has already been mentioned in combination with other methods, nor was it an unusual method to starve the prisoner into confession. Actually, the starvation technique, like interrogation at night, was an integral element in the entire system of coercion. The miserly prison bread ration, amounting to 10.5 ounces in the peacetime year of 1933, and to 1 pound in 1945 in the Lubyanka, and permitting or prohibiting food parcels from one's family and access to the commissary, were universally applied to everyone. But there was also the technique of intensified hunger. For example, Chulpenyev was kept for a month on 3.5 ounces of bread, after which, when he had just been brought in from the pit, the interrogator Sokol placed in front of him a pot of thick borscht and 1/2 loaf of white bread sliced diagonally. What does it matter, one might ask, how it was sliced? But Chulpenyev even today will insist that it was really sliced very attractively. However, he was not given a thing to eat. How ancient it all is, how medieval, how primitive. The only thing new about it was that it was applied in a socialist society. Others, too, tell about such tricks. They were often tried. But we are going to cite another case involving Chebotaryev, because it combined so many methods. They put him in the interrogator's office for 72 hours, and the only thing he was allowed was to be taken to the toilet. For the rest, they allowed him neither food nor drink, even though there was water in a carafe right next to him. Nor was he permitted to sleep. Throughout, there were 3 interrogators in the office, working in shifts. One kept writing something, silently, without disturbing the prisoner. The second slept on the sofa, and the third walked around the room, and as soon as Chebotaryev fell asleep, beat him instantly. Then they switched roles. Maybe they themselves were being punished for failure to deliver. And then, all of a sudden, they brought Chebotaryev a meal, fat Ukrainian borscht, a chop, fried potatoes, and red wine in a crystal carafe. But because Chebotaryev had had an aversion to alcohol all his life, he refused to drink the wine, and the interrogator couldn't go too far in forcing him to, because that would have spoiled the whole game. After he had eaten, they said to him, "Now here's what you have testified to in the presence of two witnesses. Sign here." In other words, he was to sign what had been silently composed by one interrogator in the presence of another, who had been asleep, and a third, who had been actively working. On the very first page, Tripotaryov learned he had been on intimate terms with all the leading Japanese generals, and that he had received espionage assignments from all of them. He began to cross out whole pages. They beat him up and threw him out. Blaginin, another Chinese Eastern Railroad man, arrested with him, was put through the same thing. But he drank the wine, and in a state of pleasant intoxication, signed the confession, and was shot. Even one tiny glass can have an enormous effect on a famished man, and that was a whole carafe. 27. Beatings, of a kind that leave no marks. They use rubber truncheons, and they use wooden mallets and small sandbags. It is very, very painful when they hit a bone. For example, an interrogator's jackboot on the shin, where the bone lies just beneath the skin. They beat Brigade Commander Karpunich Braven for 21 days in a row. And today he says, "Even after 30 years, all my bones ache, and my head too." In recollecting his own experience and the stories of others, he counts up to 52 methods of torture. Here is one. They grip the hand in a special vise so that the prisoner's palm lies flat on the desk, and then they hit the joints with the thin edge of a ruler, and one screams. Should we single out particularly the technique by which teeth are knocked out? They knocked out 8 of Karpunich's. In the case of the secretary of the Karelian Provincial Party Committee, G. Kuprianov, arrested in 1949, some of the teeth they knocked out were just ordinary ones of no particular account, but others were gold. At first they gave him a receipt that said his gold teeth were being kept for him, and then they caught themselves just in time and took away his receipt. As everyone knows, a blow of the fist in the solar plexus, catching the victim in the middle of a breath, leaves no mark whatever. The Lefortovo Colonel Sidorov, in the post-war period, used to take a penalty kick with his overshoes at the dangling genitals of male prisoners. Soccer players, who at one time or another have been hit in the groin by a ball, know what that kind of blow is like. There is no pain comparable to it, and ordinarily the recipient loses consciousness. In 1918, the Moscow Revolutionary Tribunal convicted the former Tsarist jailer Bondar. The most extreme measure of his cruelty that was cited was the accusation that, in one case, he had struck a political prisoner with such force that his eardrum had burst. 28. In the Novorossiysk NKVD, they invented a machine for squeezing fingernails. As a result, it could be observed later at transit prisons that many of those from Novorossiysk had lost their fingernails. 29. And what about the straitjacket? 30. And breaking the prisoner's back, as in that same Khabarovsk GPU in 1933. 31. Or bridling, also known as the swan dive. This was a Sukhanovka method, also used in Arkhangel, where the interrogator Ivkov applied it in 1940. A long piece of rough toweling was inserted between the prisoner's jaws, like a bridle. The ends were then pulled back over his shoulders and tied to his heels. Just try lying on your stomach like a wheel, with your spine breaking, and without water and food for 2 days. Is it necessary to go on with the list? Is there much left to enumerate? What won't idle, well-fed, unfeeling people invent? Brother mine, do not condemn those who, finding themselves in such a situation, turned out to be weak and confessed to more than they should have. Do not be the first to cast a stone at them. But here's the point. Neither these methods, nor even the lightest methods of all, are needed to wring testimony from the majority. For iron jaws to grip lambs who are unprepared and longing to return to their warm hearths, the relationship of forces to situations is too unequal. Oh, in how new a light does our past life appear when re-examined in the interrogator's office, abounding in dangers like an African jungle, and we had considered it so simple. You, A, and your friend, B, have known each other for years and have complete faith in one another. When you met, you spoke out boldly about political matters, large and small. No one else was present. There was no one who could have overheard you. And you have not denounced each other, not at all. But at this point, for some reason, you, A, have been marked, hauled out of the herd by the ears, and arrested. And for some reason, well, maybe not without a denunciation on somebody's part, and not without your apprehensions as to the fate of your loved ones, and not without a certain lack of sleep, and not without a bit of punishment cell. You have decided to write yourself off, but at the same time not to betray anyone else at any price. You have therefore confessed in 4 depositions and signed them, declaring yourself to be a sworn enemy of Soviet power, because you used to tell jokes about the leader, because you thought there should be a choice of candidates at elections, because you went into the voting booth only in order to cross out the name of the only candidate, and would have done so except there was no ink in the inkwell, and because there was a 16-meter band on your radio on which you tried to catch parts of Western broadcasts through the jamming. Your own tenor has been assured, yet your ribs have remained whole, and so far you have not caught pneumonia. You have not sold anyone out, and it seems to you that you have worked things out sensibly. You have already informed your cellmates that, in your opinion, your interrogation is probably coming to an end. But lo and behold, admiring his own handwriting, and with deliberation, the interrogator begins to fill out deposition number 5. Question: were you friendly with B? Answer: yes. Question: were you frank with him about politics? Answer: no, I did not trust him. Question: but you met often? Answer: not very. Question: what does that mean, not very? According to testimony from your neighbors, he was at your house on such and such a day, and on such and such just in the past month. Was he? Answer: maybe. Question: and it was observed that on these occasions, as always, you did not drink, you did not make any noise, you spoke very quietly, and you couldn't be overheard even in the corridor? Well, friends, drink up, break bottles, curse at the top of your lungs. On that basis, you will be considered reliable. Answer: well, what of it? Question: and you used to visit him, too, and you said to him on the phone, for example, we spent such an interesting evening. Then they saw you on the street at an intersection. You were standing there together in the cold for half an hour, and you both had gloomy faces and dissatisfied expressions. In fact, they even took photographs of you during that meeting. The technological resources of agents, my friends, the technology of agents. So what did you talk about during these meetings? What about? That's a leading question. Your first idea is to say that you've forgotten what you talked about. Are you really obliged to remember? So, you've forgotten your first conversation, and the second one too, and the third, and even your interesting evening, and that time at the intersection, and your conversations with C, and your conversations with D. No, you think, I forgot is not the way out. You will be unable to maintain that position, and your mind, still shocked by your arrest, in the grip of fear, muddled by sleeplessness and hunger, seeks a way out. How to play it shrewdly in a manner that will have some verisimilitude and outsmart the interrogator? What about? It is fine if you talked about hockey. That, friends, is in all cases the least troublesome. Or about women, or even about science. Then you can repeat what was said. Science is not too far removed from hockey, but in our time everything to do with science is classified information, and they may get you for a violation of the decree on revealing state secrets. But what if you did, in actual fact, talk about the latest arrests in the city, or about the collective farms? Of course, critically, for who has anything good to say about them? Or about reducing the rate of pay for piecework? The fact remains that you frowned for half an hour at the intersection. What were you talking about there? Maybe B has already been arrested. The interrogator assures you that he has been, and that he has already given evidence against you, and that they're about to bring him in for a confrontation with you. Maybe he is sitting home very calmly and quietly, but they might very well bring him in for questioning, and then they will find out from him what you were frowning about for half an hour at that intersection. At this point, too late. You have come to understand that, because of the way life is, you and he ought to have reached an agreement every time you parted and remembered clearly what you were going to say if you were asked what you had talked about that day. Then, regardless of interrogations, your testimony and his would agree. But you had not made any such agreement. You had, unfortunately, not understood what kind of a jungle you lived in. Should you say that you were talking about going on a fishing trip? But then B might say that there was never any discussion of fishing, that you talked about correspondence school courses. In that case, instead of causing the investigation to ease up a bit, you would only tie the noose tighter. What about? What about? What about? And the idea flashes through your mind. Is it a brilliant or a fatal one? That you ought to come as close as you can to the truth of what was actually said. Of course, rounding off the sharp edges and skipping the dangerous parts. After all, people say that when you lie, you should always stay as close to the truth as possible. And maybe B will guess what's up and say approximately the same thing, and then your testimony will coincide in some respects, and they will leave you in peace. Many years later, you will come to understand that this was not really a wise idea, and that it is much smarter to play the role of someone so improbably imbecile that he can't remember one single day of his life, even at the risk of being beaten. But you have been kept awake for 3 days. You have hardly strength enough to follow the course of your own thoughts and to maintain an imperturbable expression. And you don't have even a minute to think things over. Suddenly, two interrogators, for they enjoy visiting one another, are at you. What were you talking about? What about? What about? And you testify. We were talking about collective farms, to the effect that not everything had as yet been set to rights on them, but it soon would be. We talked about the lowering of peace rates, and what in particular did you say about them? That you were delighted they had been reduced? But that wasn't the way people normally talked, it was too implausible. And so as to make it seem an altogether believable conversation, you concede that you complained just a little that they were putting on the squeeze a bit with peace rates. The interrogator writes down the deposition himself, translating it into his own language. At this meeting, we slandered party and government policy in the field of wages. And someday, B is going to accuse you. Oh, you blabbermouth, and I said we were making plans to go fishing. But you tried to outsmart your interrogator. You have a quick, abstruse mind. You are an intellectual, and you outsmarted yourself. In Crime and Punishment, Porfiry Petrovich makes a surprisingly astute remark to Raskolnikov, to the effect that he could have been found out only by someone who had himself gone through that same cat-and-mouse game, implying, so to speak, I don't even have to construct my own version with you intellectuals, you will put it together yourselves and bring it to me all wrapped up. Yes, that's so. An intellectual cannot reply with the delightful incoherence of Chekhov's malefactor. He is bound to try to build up in logical form the whole story he is being accused of, no matter how much falsehood it contains. But the interrogator butcher isn't interested in logic. He just wants to catch 2 or 3 phrases. He knows what he wants, and as for us, we are totally unprepared for anything. From childhood on, we are educated and trained for our own profession, for our civil duties, for military service, to take care of our bodily needs, to behave well, even to appreciate beauty. Well, this last not really all that much. But neither our education, nor our upbringing, nor our experience prepares us in the slightest for the greatest trial of our lives, being arrested for nothing and interrogated about nothing. Novels, plays, films. Their authors should themselves be forced to drink the cup of gulag to the bottom. Depict the types one meets in the offices of interrogators as chivalrous guardians of truth and humanitarianism, as our loving fathers. We are exposed to lectures on everything under the sun, and are even herded in to listen to them. But no one is going to lecture to us about the true and extended significance of the criminal code, and the codes themselves are not on open shelves in our libraries, nor sold at newsstands, nor do they fall into the hands of the heedless young. It seems a virtual fairy tale that somewhere, at the ends of the earth, an accused person can avail himself of a lawyer's help. This means having beside you in the most difficult moment of your life a clear-minded ally who knows the law. The principle of our interrogation consists further in depriving the accused of even a knowledge of the law. An indictment is presented. And here, incidentally, is how it's presented. Sign it. It's not true. Sign. But I'm not guilty of anything. It turns out that you are being indicted under the provisions of Articles 5810, Part 2, and 5811 of the Criminal Code of the Russian Republic. Sign. But what do these sections say? Let me read the code. I don't have it. Well, get it from your department head. He doesn't have it either. Sign. But I want to see it. You are not supposed to see it. It isn't written for you, but for us. You don't need it. I'll tell you what it says. These sections spell out exactly what you are guilty of. And anyway, at this point, your signature doesn't mean that you agree with the indictment, but that you've read it, that it's been presented to you. All of a sudden, a new combination of letters, UPK, flashes by on one of the pieces of paper. Your sense of caution is aroused. What's the difference between the UPK and the UK, the criminal code? If you've been lucky enough to catch the interrogator when he is in a good mood, he will explain it to you. The UPK is the Code of Criminal Procedure. What? This means that there are two distinct codes, not just one, of whose contents you are completely ignorant, even as you are being trampled under their provisions. Since that time, 10 years have passed, then 15. The grass has grown thick over the grave of my youth. I served out my term, and even eternal exile as well. And nowhere, neither in the cultural education sections of the camps, nor in district libraries, nor even in medium-sized cities, have I seen with my own eyes, held in my own hands, been able to buy, obtain, or even ask for the code of Soviet law. Those familiar with our atmosphere of suspicion will understand why it was impossible to ask for the code in a people's court or in the district executive committee. Your interest in the code would be an extraordinary phenomenon. You must either be preparing to commit a crime or be trying to cover your tracks. And of the hundreds of prisoners I knew who had gone through interrogation and trial, and more than once too, who had served sentences in camp and in exile, none had ever seen the code or held it in his hand. It was only when both codes were 35 years old and on the point of being replaced by new ones that I saw them, two little paperback brothers, the UK or Criminal Code and the UPK or Code of Criminal Procedure, on a newsstand in the Moscow subway. Because they were outdated, it had been decided to release them for general circulation. I read them today, touched with emotion. For example, the UPK, the Code of Criminal Procedure. Article 136. The interrogator does not have the right to extract testimony or a confession from an accused by means of compulsion and threats. It was as though they had foreseen it. Article 111. The interrogator is obliged to establish clearly all the relevant facts, both those tending toward acquittal and any which might lessen the accused's measure of guilt. But it was I who helped establish Soviet power in October. It was I who shot Kolchak. I took part in the dispossession of the kulaks. I saved the state 10 million rubles in lowered production costs. I was wounded twice in the war. I have 3 orders and decorations. You're not being tried for that. History, the bared teeth of the interrogator. Whatever good you may have done has nothing to do with the case. Article 139. The accused has the right to set forth his testimony in his own hand and to demand the right to make corrections in the deposition written by the interrogator. Oh, if we had only known that in time. But what I should say is, if that were only the way it really was, we were always vainly imploring the interrogator not to write my repulsive, slanderous fabrications instead of my mistaken statements, or not to write our underground weapons arsenal instead of my rusty Finnish knife. If only the defendants had first been taught some prison science, if only interrogation had been run through first in rehearsal, and only afterward for real, They didn't, after all, play that interrogation game with the second termers of 1948. It would have gotten them nowhere. But newcomers had no experience, no knowledge, and there was no one from whom to seek advice. The loneliness of the accused. That was one more factor in the success of unjust interrogation. The entire apparatus threw its full weight on one lonely and inhibited will. From the moment of his arrest and throughout the entire shock period of the interrogation, the prisoner was, ideally, to be kept entirely alone. In his cell, in the corridor, on the stairs, in the offices. He was not supposed to encounter others like himself, in order to avoid the risk of his gleaning a bit of sympathy, advice, support from someone's smile or glance. The organs did everything to blot out for him his future and distort his present, to lead him to believe that his friends and family had all been arrested and that material proof of his guilt had been found. It was their habit to exaggerate their power to destroy him and those he loved, as well as their authority to pardon, which the organs didn't even have. They pretended that there was some connection between the sincerity of a prisoner's repentance and a reduction in his sentence or an easing of the camp regimen. No such connection ever existed. While the prisoner was still in a state of shock and torment and totally beside himself, they tried to get from him very quickly as many irreparably damaging items of evidence as possible, and to implicate with him as many totally innocent persons as possible. Some defendants became so depressed in these circumstances that they even asked not to have the depositions read to them. They could not stand hearing them. They asked merely to be allowed to sign them, just to sign and get it over with. Only after all this was over would the prisoner be released from solitary into a large cell, where, in belated desperation, he would discover and count over his mistakes one by one. How was it possible not to make mistakes in such a duel? Who could have failed to make a mistake? We said that, ideally, he was to be kept alone. However, in the overcrowded prisons of 1937, and for that matter of 1945 as well, this ideal of solitary confinement for a newly arrested defendant could not be attained. Almost from his first hours, the prisoner was, in fact, in a terribly overcrowded common cell. But there were virtues to this arrangement, too, which more than made up for its flaws. The overcrowding of the cells not only took the place of the tightly confined solitary box, but also assumed the character of a first-class torture in itself, one that was particularly useful because it continued for whole days and weeks, with no effort on the part of the interrogators. The prisoners tortured the prisoners. The jailer pushed so many prisoners into the cell that not everyone had even a piece of floor. Some were sitting on others' feet, and people walked on people and couldn't even move about at all. Thus, in the Kishinev KPZs, cells for preliminary detention, in 1945, they pushed 18 prisoners into a cell designed for the solitary confinement of one person. In Lugansk, in 1937, it was 15. And the interrogation there lasted 8 to 10 months at a time. Maybe Klim, Voroshilov, had one of these to himself, said the fellows there. Was he, in fact, ever imprisoned? And in 1938, Ivanov Razumnik found 140 prisoners in a standard butyrki cell intended for 25, with toilets so overburdened that prisoners were taken to the toilet only once a day, sometimes at night. And the same thing was true of their outdoor walk as well. That same year in the butyrki, those newly arrested, who had already been processed through the bath and the boxes, sat on the stairs for several days at a stretch, waiting for departing prisoner transports to leave and release space in the cells. T. Blank V. had been imprisoned in the butyrki 7 years earlier, in 1931, and says that it was overcrowded under the bunks and that prisoners lay on the asphalt floor. I myself was imprisoned 7 years later, in 1945, and it was just the same. But recently I received from MKB blank CH valuable personal testimony about overcrowding in the butyrki in 1918. In October of that year, during the second month of the Red Terror, it was so full that they even set up a cell for 70 women in the laundry. When, then, was the butyrki not crowded? It was Ivanov Razumnik who, in the Lubyanka reception kennel, calculated that for weeks at a time there were three persons for each square yard of floor space. Just as an experiment, try to fit three people into that space. But this too is no miracle. In the Vladimir internal prison in 1948, 30 people had to stand in a cell 10 feet by 10 feet in size. S. Potapov. In this kennel, there was neither ventilation nor a window, and the prisoner's body heat and breathing raised the temperature to 40 or 45 degrees centigrade, 104 to 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and everyone sat there in undershorts with their winter clothing piled beneath them. Their naked bodies were pressed against one another, and they got eczema from one another's sweat. They sat like that for weeks at a time, and were given neither fresh air nor water, except for gruel and tea in the morning. By and large, there is a good deal in Ivanov Razumnik's book that is superficial and personal, and there are many exhaustingly monotonous jokes. But the real life of the cells in the 1937 to 1938 period is very well described there. And if at the same time the latrine bucket replaced all other types of toilet, or if on the other hand there was no latrine bucket for use between trips to an outside toilet, as was the case in several Siberian prisons, and if four people ate from one bowl, sitting on each other's knees, and if someone was hauled out for interrogation, and then someone else was pushed in, beaten up, sleepless and broken, and if the appearance of such broken men was more persuasive than any threats on the part of the interrogators, and if by then death and any camp whatever seemed easier to a prisoner who had been left unsummoned for months than his tormented current situation, perhaps this really did replace the theoretically ideal isolation in solitary. And you could not always decide in such a porridge of people with whom to be forthright, and you could not always find someone from whom to seek advice. And you would believe in the tortures and beatings not when the interrogator threatened you with them, but when you saw their results on other prisoners. You could learn from those who had suffered that they could give you a salt water douche in the throat and then leave you in a box for a day tormented by thirst, karpunich. Or that they might scrape the skin off a man's back with a grater till it bled, and then oil it with turpentine. Brigade Commander Rudolf Pintsov underwent both treatments. In addition, they pushed needles under his nails and poured water into him to the bursting point, demanding that he confess to having wanted to turn his brigade of tanks against the government during the November parade. In actual fact, he did lead his brigade at the parade, but for some reason he did not turn it against the government. But this was not taken into account. However, after these most varied tortures, he was sentenced to 10 years by the OSO. To that degree, the gendarmes themselves had no faith in their achievements. And from Alexandrov, the former head of the arts section of the All-Union Society for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries, who has a broken spinal column which tilts to one side, and who cannot control his tear ducts, and thus cannot stop crying, one can learn how Abakumov himself could beat in 1948. Yes, yes, Minister of State Security Abakumov himself did not by any means spurn such menial labor. A Suvorov at the head of his troops, he was not averse to taking a rubber truncheon in his hands every once in a while, and his deputy, Ryumin, was even more willing. He did this at Sukharovka, in the General's interrogation office. The office had imitation walnut panelling on the walls, silk portières at the windows and doors, and a great Persian carpet on the floor. In order not to spoil all this beauty, a dirty runner, bespattered with blood, was rolled out on top of the carpet when a prisoner was being beaten. When Ryumin was doing the beating, he was assisted not by some ordinary guard, but by a colonel. "And so," said Ryumin politely, stroking his rubber truncheon, which was 4 centimetres, 1.5 inches thick, "you have survived trial by sleeplessness with honour." Alexander D. had cleverly managed to last a month without sleep, by sleeping while he was standing up. "So now we will try the club. Prisoners can't take more than 2 or 3 sessions of this. Let down your trousers and lie down on the runner." The colonel sat down on the prisoner's back. A.D. was going to count the blows. He didn't yet know about a blow from a rubber truncheon on the sciatic nerve when the buttocks have disappeared as a consequence of prolonged starvation. The effect is not felt in the place where the blow is delivered. It explodes inside the head. After the first blow, the victim was mad with pain and broke his nails on the carpet. Ryumin beat away, trying to hit accurately. The colonel pressed down on AD's torso. This was just the right sort of work for three big shoulderboard stars assisting the all-powerful Ryumin. After the beating, the prisoner could not walk and, of course, was not carried. They just dragged him along the floor. What was left of his buttocks was soon so swollen that he could not button his trousers, and yet there were practically no scars. He was hit by a violent case of diarrhea, and sitting there on the latrine bucket in solitary, A.D. guffawed. He went through a second and a third session, and his skin cracked, and Ryumin went wild and started to beat him on the stomach, breaking through the intestinal wall and creating an enormous hernia through which A.D.'s intestines protruded. The prisoner was taken off to the Butyrki hospital with a case of peritonitis, and for the time being their attempts to compel him to commit a foul deed were suspended. That is how they can torture you, too. After that it could seem a simple fatherly caress when the Kishinev interrogator Danilov beat Father Viktor Shipovalnikov across the back of the head with a poker and pulled him by his long hair. It is very convenient to drag a priest around in that fashion. Ordinary laymen can be dragged by the beard from one corner of the office to the other. And Richard Ohola, a Finnish Red Guard, and a participant in the capture of British agent Sidney Riley, and commander of a company during the suppression of the Kronstadt revolt, was lifted up with pliers, first by one end of his great moustaches, and then by the other, and held for 10 minutes with his feet off the floor. But the most awful thing they can do with you is this: undress you from the waist down, place you on your back on the floor, pull your legs apart, seat assistants on them from the glorious corps of sergeants, who also hold down your arms, and then the interrogator, and women interrogators have not shrunk from this, stands between your legs and with the toe of his boot or of her shoe, gradually, steadily, and with even greater pressure, crushes against the floor those organs which once measure a man. He looks into your eyes and repeats his questions, or the betrayal he is urging on you. If he does not press down too quickly or just a shade too powerfully, you still have 15 seconds left in which to scream that you will confess to everything, that you are ready to see arrested all 20 of those people he's been demanding of you, or that you will slander in the newspapers everything you hold holy. And may you be judged by God, but not people. "There is no way out. You have to confess to everything," whisper the stoolies who have been planted in the cell. "It's a simple question. Hang on to your health," say people with common sense. "You can't get new teeth," those who have already lost them nod at you. "They're going to convict you in any case, whether you confess or whether you don't," conclude those who have got to the bottom of things. "Those who don't sign get shot," prophesies someone else in the corner, "out of vengeance, so as not to risk any leaks about how they conduct interrogations. And if you die in the interrogator's office, they'll tell your relatives you've been sentenced to camp without the right of correspondence, and then just let them look for you." This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.